The Alliance of Blacks and Seminoles, 1750 to 1840. In the early 1800s, it was the policy of the new American government, having won its own freedom, to remove all Native Americans from east of the Mississippi River to the territory that later would become the states of Arkansas and Oklahoma. The Union government used the Indian Removal Act to clear the way for white settlement of Indian lands in eastern and southern portions of the United States. The act was signed in 1830 by President Andrew Jackson. The Lower Creeks occupied land adjacent to Spanish Florida in what later would become Georgia and Alabama. They and the powerful Cherokee Nation were the largest of the southeastern tribes. In 1750, Chief Secaufe and some of his followers broke away from the Creeks. These Indians became known as Seminoles, or runaways. The belligerent Seminoles resented the attempts to remove them to the West, and in the early 1800s, they migrated in earnest into Spanish Florida. Blacks were also moving into the area at about the same time in order to escape slavery. As the Seminoles settled into Florida and developed their own towns and farms, they acquired a number of slaves, although it is not clear why. They may have done so as a way of imitating whites, among whom the owning of black slaves appeared to be a symbol of power and influence. However, Seminole slavery was a relatively benign system in which the slaves tilled the land, kept a portion of the annual profit, if any, for themselves, and gave the balance to their Seminole landowner. The laxity with which the Indians treated their blacks worried many slaveholders in Florida and Georgia, who insisted that their slaves were running away in order to join the Indian-owned slaves. The black Seminoles, as they were sometimes called, lived in the same way as their Indian owners and allies. They dressed like them and hunted and fished as the Indians did. When Seminoles were removed from Florida between 1838 and 1843, nearly 500 persons of African descent accompanied them. Some of the blacks had only recently joined the Seminoles through purchase, theft, or escape from nearby plantations. Several black families, however, had lived among the Indians as slaves or free blacks for 50 years or more as part of an alliance of Africans and Seminoles, which began about the time the Seminoles first became recognized as a tribe separate from the Creeks. In times of conflict with whites, such as when the government attempted to remove the Indians and return blacks to slave plantations, the blacks often cast their lot with the Indians. The Indians repaid them with their loyalty and respect. They also grew more dependent upon the blacks as interpreters in their dealings with whites. There was some intermarriage between the two groups, but their primary bond was their mutual need to survive in the Florida wilderness against the ever-increasing threat of the United States Army. The impact of the conflict with the Army was experienced throughout the Florida Territory as ultimately full-scale war erupted. The important role of blacks in this conflict generally has been not recognized. Florida's three Seminole Wars were essentially about black people. The Seminoles simply refused to surrender to the slavers' chains, the blacks upon whom they'd come to rely. Some of the blacks who moved south with the Seminoles became distinguished leaders among the Indians and occasionally even led them into battle against military forces of the United States and on raids on white settlements. But their most indispensable function was language interpretation. The most noted among the black interpreters was a former slave called Negro Abraham, who had escaped from Georgia and embarked on a new life with the Seminoles, marrying an Indian woman. He was characterized by the Army's commanding general in the field as, quote, a Negro chief and the most cunning and intelligent Negro we have here, unquote. On March 28, 1833, with Abraham as their interpreter, the Seminoles signed what they thought was a preliminary set of conditions for their eventual removal to the West. They were embittered when the government informed them that they had in fact signed a binding treaty requiring them to vacate their lands immediately. The matter soured Abraham, who was accused by some of selling out the Indians. Maintaining his innocence, he never again lent his name in treaty negotiations. Blacks were present and participated when Seminoles massacred more than 100 white soldiers marching between Tampa and Ocala in the winter of 1834. Their commander was Brevet Major Francis Langhorne Dade, the man after whom Dade County is named. On December 28, 1834, a cold and rainy day, blacks joined forces with the Indians at the Great Wahoo Swamp. Together, they attacked Dade, who was marching with two companies and a six-pound cannon from Fort Brooke, now called Tampa, to Fort King, near present-day Ocala. As the major tried to cheer the men on from horseback at the head of the column, his troops sluiced their way along the little trail called the Fort King Road. Dozens of Indians suddenly rose from the palmetto bushes and from behind pine trees, firing at point-blank range. A bullet ripped through Day's heart, killing him before he hit the ground. Half of his men, more than 50, fell at the first volley. Satisfied with their swift victory, the Seminoles withdrew. The battle might have ended then, except for an astonishing development. Instead of dispersing and taking cover in the pine woods, Day's decimated forces chopped down small pine trees and hastily arranged them in a triangular fortification. The Indians, dumbfounded, watched from a distance as the soldiers boxed themselves in, presenting an opportunity that the chiefs could not ignore. In a final deadly assault, the Indians stormed the small fortification and overwhelmed the surviving soldiers. They left no one standing, then retired from the field. An expert on the Dade massacre gave this account of what happened next. Quote, "In a little while, the weapons had been gathered, and the Indians left the quiet enclosure, passing back through the woods towards the west, taking their three dead with them. Nearly 50 Negroes, runaway slaves, and Confederates of the Seminoles reined in and slid to the ground from saddleless horses. White eyes rolling in dark faces, they leaned on the barricade and saw for the first time white masters at their mercy. Escaped from brutal owners and stripped of everything but hate, they heard with pleasure the sounds of dying white men. Taking up the falling axes of the work crew and drawing the assorted knives they carried, they scrambled into the pen, cutting and hacking their way from man to man. Every throat that moaned was cut, and every heart that beat was stabbed. In the cold blue sky, the first vulture circled slowly." Unquote. The bodies remained unburied for more than 50 days. On the morning of February 20th, nearly 2 months after the battle, an army of 1,100 men reached the battleground. Quote, "Gracious God, what a sight," unquote, wrote Lieutenant James Duncan. Quote, "The vultures rose in clouds as the approach of the column drove them from their prey. The very breastwork was black with them. Some hovered over us as we looked upon the scene before us, whilst others settled upon the adjoining trees awaiting our departure." Unquote. On the day of the battle, Major Dade had a black guide named Louis Fatio, also called Louis Pacheco. Dade used him to scout ahead of his troops. It had been asserted that Pacheco disclosed the troops' movements to the Seminoles, but this is almost certainly not true. The Indians had been watching Dade's column virtually since the time it left Tampa. The only route the troop could have taken was the Fort King Road. The Seminoles didn't need Pacheco to tell them that. For a time, it was assumed that the former slave and guide was buried with the rest of Dade's command, but the slave had survived the attack. In the early summer of 1837, he returned to Fort Brooke, the embarkation point of the Dade command. The first volley on that fateful morning had missed Pacheco, but with great presence of mind, he had dropped immediately to the ground and played dead. With Major Dade and the advance guard lying dead in front of him and the Seminoles approaching during the first attack, he had risen to his feet and pleaded for his life, explaining that he was a slave accompanying the command against his will. A Seminole chief named Jumper ordered his life spared, and Pacheco became Jumper's property thereafter. Chief Jumper accompanied Pacheco to his return to Fort Brooke, and the military authorities accepted his story. So, instead of being executed as a spy, Pacheco was sent west with a group of Seminoles to the Oklahoma Territory, where although technically he was still a slave, he lived on equal footing with the Indians. Later, he was sold again and taken to Austin, Texas, where he lived for 40 years. Presumably, he gained his freedom, though little is known of his life in Texas. The Dade massacre was big news all over America. Nothing like it had ever happened. This Indian victory in the Florida pine woods would be surpassed in American history only by the slaughter of General George Armstrong Custer and his men at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in southeastern Montana several decades later. Following the Dade massacre, General Thomas Sidney Jessup was charged with rounding up and removing all Seminoles and escaped slaves from Florida. He deployed an army of 8,000 men, the most formidable ever assembled in the territory up to that time. The debilitating effects of warfare waged by this overwhelming force marked the beginning of the decline of black influence among the Seminoles. Gradually, blacks surrendered, tiring of the unending conflict. Some told dreadful stories of the hardships involved in living closely with Indians under war conditions. The remaining Indians and a handful of blacks who stayed with them were forced further south on the peninsula towards the newly established Dade County. In the mid-1800s, a small band of Cuban Maroons, or Spanish Negroes, a mixture of Cuban, black, and Indian ancestry, already resided on the southern tip of the Florida Peninsula. This band, which may have included escaped slaves from the failed Farnell's expedition to Key Biscayne, remained neutral until August 7, 1840, when they participated in an attack on Indian Key. That attack resulted in the death of Dr. Henry Perrine, a well-known botanist who was the first man to plant mangoes in Florida, and after whom a section of South Dade County was later named. Although the old ties between blacks and Seminoles may not be generally known by people in South Florida today, they're common knowledge among Seminoles. "We had a lot of blacks that spoke well the Creek language," my mother used to say, explained Mabel Jumper in an interview in 1990. Quote, "The colored people spoke the Indian language, and they spoke English, so they could tell the Indians what the white people were doing," unquote, Jumper said. She noted that her great-grandfather owned and kept slaves in the typical Seminole way. Intermarriage between blacks and Seminoles was not encouraged, since Seminoles generally looked upon blacks as being inferior to themselves. Still, Indians interviewed for this work could describe Indian children within their various family groups today who are dark-skinned and have nappy hair as living testimony to the Seminole-Black alliance. The Seminole view of blacks is revealed in the following legend. As is apparent, the Indians viewed neither blacks nor whites as their equals. "The Master of Light said, 'We will make man.' Man was made. But when he stood up before the Master, he was white. The Great Spirit was sorry. He saw that the being he had made was pale and weak. He took pity on him, and therefore he did not unmake him, but let him live. He tried again, for he was determined to make a perfect man. But in his endeavor to avoid making another white man, he went into the opposite extreme, and when the second being rose up and stood before him, he was black. The Great Spirit liked the black man less than the white, and he shoved him aside to make room for another trial. Then it was that he made the red man, and the red man pleased him. In this way, the Great Spirit made the white, the black, and the red man when he put them on the earth. Here they were, but they were poor. They had no lodges, nor horses, nor tools to work with, nor traps, nor anything with which to hunt or kill game. All at once, these three men, looking up, saw three large boxes coming down from the sky. The Great Spirit said, 'White man, you are pale and weak, but I made you first, and I will give you the first choice. Go to the boxes, open them, and look in, and choose which one you will take for your portion.' The white man said, 'I will take this.' The box was filled with pens and ink and paper and compasses and such things. The Great Spirit spoke again and said, 'Black man, I made you next, but I do not like you. You may stand aside. The red man is my choice. He shall come forward and make the next choice.' The red man stepped boldly up and chose a box filled with tomahawks, knives, war clubs, traps, and other such things as are useful in war and hunting. The Great Spirit laughed when he saw how well his red son knew how to choose. Then he said to the Negro, 'You may have what is left. The third box is for you.' That box was filled with axes and hoes, with buckets to carry water in, and long whips for driving oxen, which meant the Negro must work for both the red and white man. And thus it has been ever since. Still, the blacks' only bondage was ignorance. Blacks, like men and women with no skill to offer only their hands, their brains could do nothing but manual labor. But being men and women, they learned. They put themselves under the protection of one chief or another and called him master, and to whom, for this consideration, they rendered a tribute of 1/3 of the produce of the land and 1/3 of the horses, cattle, and fowl they may raise. Otherwise, they are free to come and go at their pleasure, and in some cases are elevated to the position of equality with their masters," unquote. Folk tales and legends reflect the peoples and cultures from which they spring. It is apparent from this old Indian myth that racism is the domain of no single group.